From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Author, journalist, music critic, and historian Robert Greenfield is my guest. His books include biographies of Jerry Garcia, Timothy Leary, and Ahmet Erdogan. He is also the co-author of Bill Graham's autobiography, and he's written books about the Rolling Stones. His STP, A Journey Through America with the Rolling Stones, is a classic, and his latest book, published last year, is Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye, The Rolling Stones on the Road to Exile. Robert Greenfield, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you, Gary. It's good to be here, and the only thing I would say is that I actually have never considered myself to be a music critic.
Okay. You did write for Rolling Stone at one time, right?
But I never did criticism, and I am not a great fan of critics.
What do they know? What do they know?
Well, they know everything, and that's the problem. I mean, I don't know what they do. This is the issue, but I've never really tried to judge the music of the people that I've written about, you know? I feel like it's something that is for people to enjoy, and there is some great music criticism, I gotta say. Mm-hmm. There are some music critics I really respect, but it's become a separate industry, you know? And it's just not something that I've ever felt qualified to get involved
in. So you never wrote a record review in your years at Rolling Stone?
Never. I will confess that there's a book coming out later this year called Men of Wealth and Fame, which is a compilation of these astonishing photographs that were taken for Beggar's Banquet, which is really the transitional album in the Rolling Stones' career. They hired a photographer and did an elaborate movie set. They're extraordinary color photographs that have never really been seen. And I did a 10,000-word essay there in which I list the tracks on Beggar's Banquet and discuss them. But again, there are people who are just much more well-versed in music to be able to tell you what Keith is playing in that section and what the tuning is. And I really don't know those things.
Yeah. Well, you know, this seems like a great time for to talk about and read about the Rolling Stones, uh-huh, because the Stones are on tour. They just released Sticky Fingers and a uh-huh new reissue, which includes that Leeds concert. Now, I think you were present.
Right. Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye, which is a line from Angie, not one of my favorite Stones songs, deals with the first Rolling Stones tour I was ever on in March 1971 in England. They toured for 10 days. They did two shows a night, which is extraordinary, in tiny venues, 2,500 seats, 3,000 seats, these decrepit town halls all over England, Manchester, Newcastle. They did the Student Union in Leeds. And they traveled by bus. They traveled by train, sitting in ordinary compartments. It is truly a tour from another era. It's the last time they ever went on the road in that manner, and much of the music that they played, I was fortunate enough to be on stage for every show, standing by the piano, which was played by the late Nicky Hopkins and the late Ian Stewart, both of whom were incredible piano players, very different one from the other, and a lot of the music they were playing was from Sticky Fingers. They were playing Bitch, and they were playing Brown Sugar. The only problem, them being the Rolling Stones at that point, which was significantly synonymous with the word chaos, that the album had not been released. Nobody had ever heard this music, and I was getting it drummed into my head twice a night, and you couldn't go anywhere and then listen to it, because the album didn't come out until long after the tour was over. They were about to leave England to go into tax exile in the south of France, where they recorded some of Exile on Main Street, and this was their farewell tour of Great Britain.
It's funny, because when you listen to Sticky Fingers now, it's like a greatest hits record.
Well, it's really interesting you say that. Sticky Fingers is really significant as well, because it's the first album that's released on Rolling Stone Records, distributed by Ahmet Erdogan at Atlantic, and it was to date their most commercially successful album. And the tour that followed it, which I also was fortunate enough to be on, which is the one that STP is about, the 72 Tour of America, is due in great part to Ahmet and his social connections and his business acumen and the music. That's the tour that crossed them over. The previous time they'd come to America was Altamont. They were an outlaw counterculture band. And on that tour, they're playing 18,000-seat arenas. And the tour ends with a party on the roof of the St. Regis Hotel in New York that every star in the world, including Bob Dylan, and just a social melange of people who had never heard of the Stones before, they had to be there. So this is a significant era in their career, and the fact that they're out on the road now. So what the Stones are now doing is re-releasing the entire catalog one album at a time. And the first one they picked was Exile, which is of interest to me because it had such a mixed critical reception when it first came out and has since become the masterpiece, so-called. I don't consider it that, but just my opinion. And what Jagger did was all the material that didn't get on Exile, which was released there with the as bonus tracks, much of it was recorded before Sticky Fingers and for Sticky Fingers. But if you look at the albums, and I always like to say this, I would say, trying not to be a music critic here, that Beggar's Banquet, Let It Bleed, and Sticky Fingers probably are the three greatest back-to-back-to-back albums that any band has ever released.
Well, you'd have to contend with Rubber Soul, Revolver, and Sgt. Pepper there.
Exactly. Well, well said. That's up there, and I'm sure we could find three by The Who.
Yeah.
That might fit that category, but we both agree it's top five, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and for them, they're just exploding artistically. I mean, this is really, on some level, the height of their most creative period. They're not particularly playing rhythm and blues anymore, and if you want to talk about Sticky Fingers, if you listen to Moonlit Mile, which is the last track on the album, Keith, due to several issues, did not show up for the recording. And I was listening to them. They were playing that on cassette in the hotel rooms on that tour and listening to it. It was called The Japanese Thing. It didn't have a title. But that song is such a departure for people who are really interested in the Stones music. Their Satanic Majesties was such a failure critically, and they were so roundly criticized for trying to do their version of Sgt. Pepper that Beggar's Banquet starts to come back. And then they leave Decca, which has never been where they, you know, they had a terrible deal in their minds. And after that, it just starts getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah. Your new book, the Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye, The Rolling Stones on the Road to Exile, it's different from STP because in this book, you're like a character. In STP, you were more like the observer.
Exactly. Well, I've always been a character. I just don't like to write about myself. What I did with Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye is I found my original notebooks, which are more than 40 years old, and what I did on that tour was I never wanted them to see me take notes. I was 26 years old and really clueless on so many levels and never been on the road with anyone before, and this was my debut performance, that I would go to the loo, as it was called in England, which is the bathroom, and anybody who lived in England back then knows how foul all of those bathrooms were. And I'd write down everything that they had just said so I could get it done without them knowing I was watching and listening. So when I started going back through the notebooks, I mean, literally so much of it didn't make sense to me anymore, that the way the book is written is the way I was then and the way it happened. And then in another voice, I'm writing about what I learned after the tour, what it really meant that I had seen that I didn't understand at the time. So it's told from two different points of view, and it's the tour, and then it's my time living with Keith Richards, surviving living with Keith Richards in the south of France for a couple weeks while I did the Rolling Stone interview. Then it goes on to my experience on the American tour the following summer of 72, and then it ends in Jamaica, where I was with them as they were recording Goat's Head Soup.
Well, did you find stuff in your journals that were like, oh, I don't remember that. I don't remember that happening at all.
I don't remember if I found stuff that I didn't remember, which is a classic answer. I remembered it, but it didn't make sense in context anymore. It only made sense when I started to understand things like Mick was then with Bianca. They didn't really care for that, the Stones people. They thought she was going to take him away from the band. Nobody knew she was pregnant. I mean, I didn't know that Keith and Anita Pallenberg, who was his companion and the mother of his child, Marlon, I didn't know they were using heroin. It seems impossible to to understand now, but as I came to understand, is that by the time I got there, the Stones had been so famous for 6 years. And they really were brilliant at being public figures who were still able to hide their private lives. I was there with them all the time. I was in the dressing room. I never saw anyone use heroin. Everything that went on was under the cover of night, as we say. And so that's why the book is basically the way it was and the way it became and what I came to understand long after it was all over.
We're talking with Robert Greenfield, and his latest book is called Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye, The Rolling Stones on the Road to Exile. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. In STP, because you're not, I mean, you're like the god who's telling the story, but were you there at the Playboy Mansion and things like that?
Oh, yes. Oh, my God, yes. Yes, I was put on the road by Rolling Stone magazine and was there for the entire first half of the tour. And then Jan Wenner, for reasons known only to him, brought Truman Capote on, who was traveling with Princess Lee Radziwill, Jackie Onassis's sister, and a photographer named Peter Beard. So then I was off the road, but then I rejoined them in New York for the final concert. So, yeah, most of what's in STP, virtually all of it, is firsthand. And then after the tour was over, I traveled basically around the world and interviewed everybody who'd been on the tour. So what I didn't see is what people told me had happened, and I always, you know, cross-referenced everything. So, but it was so different. I mean, astonishingly enough, it's 18 months after the English tour, and it bears no resemblance to the English tour. It was like Sherman's March to the Sea. They were conquering heroes. They had levels of security. They stayed on their own floors in hotels. They flew in a private jet that I was on with them. It was the difference back then. There was the difference between England and America. It's an astonishing, you know, it's not like that anymore. These places, everywhere in the world is not as different one from the other as they used to be. But this was two different universes.
So much, really, attitudes about so many things have changed. I mean, of course, drugs, the attitude of about drugs has completely changed.
in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, well, LSD in particular. I don't think, I was reading Graham Nash's book recently, and he said...
I've read it, yeah.
Yeah, he said he doesn't think people do LSD anymore because they don't want to look into themselves in the same way that they did then.
Well, it's funny you should mention this. I find myself writing a book about Augustus Owsley Stanley III.
The LSD guy.
The greatest street chemist who ever lived, who bankrolled the Grateful Dead, who provided basically all of the LSD in that era that even the Beatles were taking. Everyone was taking Owsley if they were able to get it. And I think people are doing LSD now. Nobody's in my office doing it as we speak, but I think it's back in the culture. The Stones were past their LSD phase. You know, they were always on the cutting edge, and you know, they were getting high on acid in London when they got busted at Keith's house, the famous bust that makes them authentic counterculture heroes. But by 1970, the drugs of choice in England for them were definitely, you know, English hashish joints, cocaine. And then on the American tour, it was totally out of control. They were doing amyl nitrates. And, you know, as I said, I didn't know it on the English tour, on the American tour as well. Keith was, you know, then deeply into the period where he was addicted to heroin.
And attitudes about women or girls have certainly changed. I mean, they're essentially pedophiles. I mean, I don't want to accuse anybody of anything, but some of the, I mean, I remember in STP, and I can't remember precisely, because it's been
They bring those girls on the plane, and they shoot a scene for the movie, the documentary that has a title I can't say on the air that's
right.
Never really been released, that Robert Frank shot. There was no real sex going on there. That was a fake scene. I mean, it's funny you say that, because Stray Cat Blues, which is on Beggar's Banquet, definitely is speaking about girls who are underage, but again, this is the gap between who the Stones were and the material that they were putting out. I mean, at that point, Mick Jagger was with Bianca, who was an international socialite. Keith was with Anita Pallenberg, who was really a movie star at that point. You know, Charlie was married. Bill Wyman had a companion. So it wasn't as though they were some mad band on the road. with teenage girls being brought back into the dressing room. None of that was going
like
on.
Led Zeppelin allegedly did.
Well, they're the ones. I mean, you know, if you want to talk about people who, you know, I still have difficulty, I recognize the brilliance of the music, but if you were around in that era, and it's certainly in the Bill Graham book, what they did to people and what they did to girls, I still find so horrendous that it's difficult for me to separate out the players from the playing.
Well, let me ask you this about the Rolling Stones versus, say, Led Zeppelin. The Rolling Stones kind of came together organically. That is, they met and they, you know, loved the music and they got together.
Right, that's right.
Whereas with Led Zeppelin, you've got like Jimmy Page basically, I have an idea, let me hire this guy, I'll hire this guy.
Your point's well taken, but it's kind of yes and no. What's interesting about Jimmy Page is that he goes back to the era of Mick and Keith and Brian Jones. I mean, he was already recognized in London as a great blues player, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're back to the Blues Breakers, and we're back to Clapton. And he, you know, he had great credibility. Ian Stewart was always my guide because Stu had seen it all, and he had very little respect for anybody who didn't deserve respect. And he always felt that Pagey, as they called him, was one of the great players. But again, none of these guys were subjected to the horror in the studio, the horror backstage, the horror in the limos, you know, and well, they had a manager named Peter Grant who was a nightmare, okay? So the Stones were from another era on some level, and also they came into the business in England when what they were playing night after night were, again, church halls in the beginning, traveling in a beat-up Volkswagen van, you know, playing to, screaming teenage girls, but like maybe 200, 300, you know? So that's different from putting out an album and coming to America and being worshipped as rock gods. Stones came to America in 66, and they were basically hated. They were not welcomed here like the Beatles. They were regarded as the Sex Pistols were later. They were
the evil version of the Beatles.
They were punk. They were nightmares, okay? And so when you've had to deal with that, it kind of changes your sensibility.
Yeah. Well, you encountered some interesting people, and I want to talk about the Rolling Stones, but about some of these other people, too. I love this scene where you're escorting Graham Parsons.
Poor Graham, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, well, if I could describe it briefly, I may see it, I won't get into detail, but we were in Brighton, England, which is a seaside town, and playing a horribly big disco. And, you know, I knew who Graham was, and I had great respect for his music. He was out of the Byrds at that point. He was kind of a lost soul, and he was depending on the Rolling Stones, who he adored, to get him a record deal with their new label. He was there hanging out with Keith. He and Keith had gone through a horrifying drug rehab before the tour, but then they were using again. And one night in Brighton, I was given the job of getting Graham Parsons to the stage. I'll try to make this story short. We got lost, okay, and we were trapped in this set of the endless, we talk about LSD, I was not on it, but it felt like it. kept walking upstairs and all the doors were locked and I could feel Graham Parsons freaking out, losing it really seriously, and I was in charge of him and I was trying to take care of him, and finally after what seemed like hours of climbing these stairs, we opened this door and we stepped into the balcony of a movie theater. We were upstairs in the loge, and in front of us on a 40-foot screen was the movie Myra Breckinridge, which if anybody has seen Raquel Welch, it's a nightmare.
One of the worst films ever made.
If you're not in this altered state, it's a nightmare. And we looked at each other like we are now in the ninth circle of hell. And I somehow got him back downstairs, and I got him to the stage. But, you know, there were so many casualties. And then Graham came to the south of France to hang out with Keith, and then he got asked to leave. You know, when I wrote Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye, and I started realizing how many people had been in Keith's house when I was there who were no longer alive, it's you know, again, if you knew them and you had some sort of relationship with them, which I did, it's almost like it was a war zone.
Well, I guess it has been a lot of years, but still, rock and roll casualties are pretty great.
from that era, in that era, I mean, what I find astonishing is they were in the south of France doing exile, doing heroin. Jim Morrison dies in Paris. It doesn't affect any of them. In other words, that's the level of insulation. And that's also what the drug brings about. Like, well, man, Keith Deal was always screwed up. You know, not Morrison specifically, but people who would die. Well, he was trying to clean up, and then he shot too much. And, you know, you can really lie to yourself about this. And, I mean, the reason the Stones can still go out on the road is that as long as it's Mick and Keith and Charlie, they're still the Rolling Stones.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's the band.
Yeah.
Wild horses couldn't drag me away. Wild, wild horses, we'll ride them someday.
We're talking with Robert Greenfield, and his latest book is called Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye, The Rolling Stones on the Road to Exile. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Yeah. So, did you get to know them all? I mean, what about Bill Wyman?
I spent a lot of time with Bill, who, you know, was a very strange and eccentric person on some level. You know, very different from them, older than them, never really a part of the band the way Mick and Keith were. You know, Keith would often re-record Bill's bass lines, you know. I mean, Mick Taylor was a big sweetheart. I had a great relationship with Mick. And Bobby Keys, who just passed away, the great sax player.
Right.
I mean, a lot of the book is about Bobby because he was such a larger-than-life character. You know, Bobby also, it's amazing he made it as long as he did. But these were, you know, not just guys who had spent their lives wanting to be rock musicians. They were authentic, I guess characters is the only word I could use. You know?
If you had to, could you give a call to Keith Richards or Mick Jagger and say, hey, it's Bob.
Well, why would I call them? I mean, that's the question. I will say this. So when I was writing the book about Ahmet Ertegun,
yeah,
I contacted the person who runs Keith's life and said, hey, you know, I'd really like to talk to Keith for the book, and then began a series of phone calls like, Keith is going to call you. Okay, I'm here. No, and then another call. Listen, he's calling you. It was like the president, you know. And of course, and this is my life, I was in the bathroom when the phone rang, you know, and I picked up the phone, and, you know, no assistant, no Keith. Oh, Bob Green! And the deal with Keith is that he does not recognize time. If you haven't spoken to Keith in 15 years, he will pick up the conversation where it left off. If you haven't spoken to Keith in 20 minutes, he'll pick up the conversation where it left off. And you know, the great thing was he was completely out of control on the phone in a fabulous way, completely unbridled, never censored himself. And at one point I said to him, Keith, you are so politically incorrect. And he said to me, yes, man, and it's all quotable.
Well, in your book, you talk about showing him the manuscript of your Rolling Stone interview.
Yeah. I went back to the house after I had transcribed it. It was over 100 pages of single-space transcript. I wanted to make sure I'd gotten everything right, and I stood there in the kitchen at Villa Nelcutt as he read each page and threw it on the floor. Just flicked it, you know, like smoking incessantly, cigarette. Flicked it on the floor, went, and I'm dying, you know. I'm dying because I don't know. He throws the last page on the floor, and he looks at me, and he said, I said it, man. Print it. And see, to my mind, that's the difference between then and now. There is no longer that kind of interface with these people. There is no longer that kind of utter lack of regard on their part as to how they're going to be judged in social media. Okay?
Right.
I mean, back then, Rolling Stone was social media. Everybody read this interview. It was a big event. Keith had never really spoken at length before. And he was astonishing in the interview, what he remembered, what he said. It was really on some level, and I'm not flattering myself here. It's all about Keith. It was the beginning of the Keith Richards legend. Like, oh, this guy's more than a guitar player. Okay?
I read it. I loved it. That's,
well, and he was, and he is. And, you know, you still see who he is now. I mean, it's great that he's so beloved. You know what I mean?
I do. You know, I read the Lennon interviews, Lennon Remembers, as it was published.
Yeah, Jan Wenner did that interview.
Right,
yeah.
And I read it, and I thought, well, you know, John, why, he's so, he's bitter. And then, recently, within the last 4 or 5 years, they made available the actual recordings of them. And when you listen to John, you think, oh, man, he's funny.
He's so great.
He was just kidding. A lot of the things that come across as mean or angry in the Lennon Remembers are really jokes, but you can't tell that because you can't hear his voice. So what about when you're interviewing Keith? Is there anything that's equivalent, like the voice, the sound of his voice makes a difference?
Well, it's interesting. I have the original cassettes, of course, and I've had it digitized, and he's amazing to listen to. I mean, his cadence and his voice. But your point is really interesting. You know, God loved John, and I did, and I do. John definitely had an edge, okay? And that's in that period, Keith didn't. I mean, he's so... Brian Jones is dead about a year and a half. And he's since said other things about Brian and didn't treat him that well in his own book. But he was still so torn up about Brian's death that, you know, he has a great heart, Keith. And he has, you know, women have always adored Keith because he's a gentleman, you know. It's so odd, right? Because here he is, this mad rocker who's swinging his guitar at people's heads when they mess with him on stage. I mean, that's why he's such a fabulous character. He is who he is in any moment in time. Mick is a much more complicated piece of work. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Mick before we run out of time.
Please.
So tell me a little bit about him.
Well, the moment in Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye that I think says a lot about Mick is that he had been so nice to me throughout the whole tour. You know, we had sat on a bus and talked, and I'd never formally interviewed him because that's not what I was working. That's not the way I was working. I was just observing them. And then between the last two shows at the Roundhouse in London, and this is something he always did with everybody, I later learned, he got in my face and accused me of not having paid attention to anything that went on the tour. Oh, you've been having a good time, and you don't know what's happened here. And I was like, I was a kid, taken aback. I didn't say anything. What was I going to say?
Right.
I'm going to argue with Mick Jagger? You know, it's like, what's the point? And then when the article came out, everything they had said and done during those 10 days was in there. And then the next time I saw him in the south of France, in Keith's house, he couldn't have been nicer. You know, it was... He always treated me well, and, you know, somebody once said I was like the embedded journalist with them for that period, and so I guess they trusted me, and therefore, you know, I don't have a bad word to say about Mick. He just was somebody who had, as, you know, Keith said, you know, Mick is a nice bunch of guys, you know.
Well, I'm glad that you took such good notes, because now we've got this wonderful book. It's called Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye, The Rolling Stones on the Road to Exile, and it deserves a spot on your bookshelf to STP
Thank you. We go back to the era we're now living in. Imagine if I had some sort of digital device that had crashed. The thing about a pen on paper is if you don't lose the notebooks in a fire, you can still read them many years later. So I do feel fortunate, yeah.
That's a great book. And Robert Greenfield, thank you so much for talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
It's been my great pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Robert Greenfield. His latest book, Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye, The Rolling Stones on the Road to Exile. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.